Hey, it's Sarah. Remember to tune into The Last Dance, which concludes this Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern on ESPN. Listen to the wrap-up podcast hosted by Jalen and Jacoby immediately following the broadcast, which is brought to you by State Farm. When you want the real deal, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Coverage is also brought to you by AT&T. You can find Jalen and Jacoby wherever you get your podcasts. That show's been great. Really great insight into the documentary, so make sure you check it out.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said. Well, that's what she said.
Welcome to That's What She Said, conversations with interesting people from the world of sports, music, comedy, and more, talking about their lives, careers, successes, and failures.
I'm Ben Cohen, and my dilemma is that my wife and I made cookies last night, and now there are just way too many cookies in our house for only two of us, and I find myself eating cookies every hour, basically.
Okay, so, see, now this is why I don't bake. I cook, I absolutely cook, but I do not bake unless I am taking those cookies or cake or brownies or whatever the heck it is immediately to someone else's house and leaving them there, because I can't be trusted. And you should know that about yourself, Ben, honestly. I mean, for starters, cut the recipe in half. Or, heck, make the dough, bake two cookies, and then freeze the rest of the dough for the next time you want a cookie, and then bake two cookies. I mean, this shouldn't be that much of a dilemma. I think you're probably subconsciously wanting many cookies, and that is why you are allowing yourself to make a full batch when you know goddamn well that you only need two cookies. Of course, you could also just say, "F it, it's quarantine. Cookie rules are off. Eat a whole tray of them. See who cares."
The commish has spoken.
My guest this week is Wall Street Journal reporter Ben Cohen, the author of The Hot Hand, The Mystery and Science of Streaks. This was such a fun conversation. I really think even if you're not a sports fan, you'll get into this because it's not just about the hot hand in sports, but everywhere. We talk about how his memory about his own hot hand in a childhood basketball game and writing two Wall Street Journal stories about this topic sent him down a rabbit hole and made him realize he wanted to write a whole book about it, wanting to understand what it is to get in the zone. Also, the surprising reason the guy who created NBA Jam created the he's on fire mode, and it has nothing to do with the hot hand. Also, how heat checks throw off hot hand research, how the hot hand is maybe not quite the same as in flow state, and also how The Princess Bride finally got made because of a creative hot hand. Also, we kind of get into how if you misread the idea of a streak, things can go very wrong. It's a great interview. I think you guys are going to like it.
That's what she said.
Excited to have Ben Cohen on to talk about this book, which I have not made it all the way through, but I'm fascinated thus far by all the many applications of the idea of the hot hand. And I love also that your background is as a basketball reporter, because that's the place that we all want to go when we think about what it means to be sort of in the zone or having a hot hand. But can that be applied to other places? Is it useful? Can it benefit us? And how can it maybe also cause problems? So I'm excited to get into all this, but we have to start at the very beginning with you and your background. So tell me a little bit about what kind of kid you were and what you were into.
Well, I loved sports and I loved journalism. I think most kids dream of growing up to be an astronaut and going to the moon. And I dreamed of covering Rutgers basketball for the Star Ledger. But I really loved basketball. And I was a terrible basketball player, which is why I now write about basketball. But this book kind of started with this one kind of magical junior varsity basketball game that I had. I cannot stress enough how bad I was at basketball. But, in one quarter of one game, I scored more points than I had in my entire career combined. I had the hot hand, which shows that it sort of strikes anybody and you really never know what is going to happen. And that game kind of stuck with me for a very long time. And I did not really understand what was going on. But I had this very clear vision of this very strange event in my life. And what I've since learned is that it really is not all that strange. I think we all have these brushes with the hot hand. We have, it's sort of this universal phenomenon that we can all relate to.
Yeah. It's funny because it is something that we most easily are able to identify with when it comes to some sort of athletic pursuit of ours. And what I want to talk about and discover over the course of this is whether it's best applied to things like that versus something gambling, which is often a matter of chance and not skill, or even something like creating art, which does require our work, but might be more subjective than whether you actually just can put the ball in the basket or not, how it changes as we apply it to different things. But so you start out, you're interested in sports and writing, which is certainly how you ended up where you are, a way to stay on brand, Ben. You go to college. What did you study and what did you at that time think you wanted to do? Were you on the fast track to writing for the Wall Street Journal from then on?
It's good that I was not on the fast track to writing about sports for the Wall Street Journal, because when I was in college, the Wall Street Journal did not have a sports section. Only when I was like a senior in college did we start this section. So I was able to sort of get in on the ground floor of something, which was very cool. But yeah, I studied English. I managed to write a book that's essentially about economics, statistics, and psychology without taking a single course in economics, statistics, or psychology. But I studied English, but really I just spent all my time at the school newspaper, the Duke Chronicle. So, you know, I was the sports editor of the paper when I was a junior in college. I probably spent, like, no joke, I don't know, 60, 70 hours a week in the office. It was a daily newspaper. We, like, put out this thing every day that I think most daily newspapers are kind of daily miracles, but like college newspapers, especially, like, right. I really have no idea how we survived. But I think, like most people who worked for their college paper, I just loved every second of it. And I knew it was what I wanted to do if anybody would have me. And I got very lucky that the Wall Street Journal needed a sports intern, and they ended up picking me. And I kind of, you know, kept my foot in the door and wouldn't let them slam it on me. And I've been there sort of ever since.
Yeah. So you stumbled upon the idea for this book by reminiscing about that aforementioned game where you had the hot hand. How long were you ruminating on it before you decided this was something you could really dive into as either a story or a book?
Well, the funny thing is that, like, I had this memory in my head, but I didn't know about this saga of the hot hand. I just thought, of course this thing happened. I had this magical feeling, and I think, like, all of us do. I didn't know that there was such a contentious debate about whether there is such a thing as the hot hand. I really only found out about that in, like, 2014. I wrote a story for the Wall Street Journal then, and then I wrote another story about the hot hand the next year. And that's really where all of this started, because it was so rich, the story. I just couldn't believe how much tension there was in this fight over a single idea, and like the people who were involved in this quest to learn more about the hot hand. And Sarah, I'm sure, like, you know, by the time you publish a story, you have reported it, you've thought about it, you've written it, you've rewritten it, you've spent all this time thinking about it, and usually you're just sick of the story by the time it runs, right? The opposite kind of happened here. I wasn't exhausted. I was kind of invigorated. There was still so much that I thought I could explore, and I just couldn't get the hot hand out of my head. And once that happened, I thought that it would be really cool to apply it far beyond basketball, because that's really why these brilliant psychologists and economists have studied the hot hand for so long. It happens to be a basketball phenomenon, but what they have learned is that basketball is this wonderful excuse to explore the rest of the world.
Yeah, and one of the ways we think about it most applying to basketball isn't just actually watching a game where we say, you know, this guy's in the zone, or remember that game when that guy was in the zone. It's also this very, like, literal hot hand in NBA Jam. So NBA Jam, you know, video game, for those who haven't played it, if you hit a number of shots with the same player in a row, then you are on fire and you're literally followed by flames and you almost can't miss, and you're possessed of an otherworldly ability to do things that even in this absurd game where people are jumping to the ceiling are even more over the top amazing. And I know that you were just on NPR talking to the person who created that game. Was there a concept of the idea and the arguments around the hot hand in that person's mind when they created this he's on fire?
No, he had no idea what he was doing.
Amazing.
But he understood the power of fire, because this guy's name is Mark Turmel. He's one of the great video game designers of his generation. And when he was a kid, there were three things that he loved. He loved basketball and he loved video games. And what he really loved was fire. He was actually a bit of a childhood pyromaniac. And the really cool thing about him is that he was able to combine these three childhood loves into the biggest hit of his life. And that was NBA Jam. So I grew up playing NBA Jam. I'm like a month or two younger than Steph Curry. So I know that he grew up playing NBA Jam because NBA Jam was kind of ubiquitous when we were, when we were kids. And what I did not realize though was that everybody grew up playing NBA Jam. Like NBA Jam was one of the most successful, lucrative arcade games ever made. In the first year, it made $1 billion in quarters, like a billion with a B. That's like crazy. And, the question that I had when thinking about this book and thinking about the Hot Hand is why? Like, why were we so obsessed with this absurd basketball video game that was actually modeled on like a sci-fi game? It wasn't, the reason it doesn't seem like any other sports game is that Mark Turmel didn't have any other sports games in mind when he was making this game. And, you know, I think that there are a lot of reasons. I think you talked about some of them. We could like somersault over the basket and we could throw down these breathtaking dunks. But really, I think this idea of getting hot, of hearing those words, he's heating up and then he's on fire, is what compelled us to keep playing. And it was almost as if Mark Turmel, this childhood pyromaniac, single-handedly brainwashed a generation of like impressionable young minds into believing in the concept of the hot hand. And I think a lot of us have never really felt otherwise. I mean, I know that I didn't until I learned about the research. And when I talked to Steph Curry about it, like, he, of course, believes in the hot hand because basically everybody in the NBA believes in the hot hand.
Yeah. And I just love the idea that he didn't conceptualize it that way. But it resulted in looking like the very thing that you would imagine if you believed in a hot hand. He's literally on fire. Okay. So you're taking these papers or these articles that you've written for the Wall Street Journal, and you start digging and you realize that there is an actual academic paper in 1985 that says, no, there is no such thing as a hot hand. You don't get in the zone. You know, it's just, we're seeing patterns where there are none because that's what our brain wants to do. So first, maybe explain to us, why do we, as you've said in previous interviews, invent causes to explain patterns?
Because it's our minds playing tricks on us. I mean, it is this cognitive bias. And we do see patterns where they don't exist. And the question of why is actually really interesting. And I haven't been able to talk about this much. It's like, why have our brains evolved this way? And it turns out, like, what evolutionary psychologists believe is that there were real benefits to thinking this way for like primitive humans and even monkeys. They've studied the hot hand in monkeys, and they have found that like when we were hunter gatherers, when we were foraging for shelter and food, there were advantages to seeing patterns because that's where the food was. The world was like super clumpy. So it's not the world that we live in now, but this belief in the hot hand, it's not a bug of the human brain. It's actually a feature. It's like how we think. Now the question is that how we should think? Like is this a cognitive bias? Is this like us acting irrationally? And I think that's what these psychologists since 1985 have really been studying. But that issue of why that you brought up is fascinating. And it's like, it's one of the things that was really fun to explore here, is that like we think, or we thought anyway, that like that believing in the hot hand was stupid. But there was a time when it wasn't stupid, right? It was actually how we should be thinking.
Yeah. And I understand why we would want to assign patterns and meaning to things, because the idea that there is no meaning and everything is random is very unsettling for the human brain. It's much easier to assign logic even to the things that we can't understand, which is probably why religion exists, right? We just need some way to explain the things that we can't. But in the case of the hot hand, it can help and hurt. And so let's get back to the study that tried to disprove it. What was so fascinating about it was they actually took a poll, and 90% of the respondents believed intuitively that the hot hand existed, but the study itself said it didn't. So that's why it was a study that people talked about and argued about far after. It wasn't definitive because no one believed it even after they proved it. So talk about why and how that study took on kind of a life of its own after, in theory, the end of it was, I mean, not that every study means that's the end of a conversation, but in their case, it just opened it up even more.
Well, it's so funny. It was too counterintuitive for its own good, right? It found something so contrarian, so unbelievable, that people just refused to believe it. And I actually, when you brought up, the poll in the study that 90% of people that they asked, I actually found myself thinking, even though I like have read that paper a million times, I actually can't believe it was only 90% because it actually feels like it should be higher than 90%. But the reason why it was such a contrarian, counterintuitive paper, like that people wouldn't believe it, is that we have all felt the hot hand. We have seen the hot hand for ourselves. And now there are these brilliant psychologists coming along telling us there is no such thing. And that is really hard for us to wrap our minds around. Our intuition suggests the opposite in such a powerful way. And what's changed in recent years is that there is some new evidence and data and ways of thinking that suggests that our intuition may have been right about this and that it's worth changing our minds again. But I do think even if that first paper, isn't, what it used to be, I still find it so admirable because I just love that like delicious, contrarian streak to think like this actually isn't real and we're going to look at that. Like I think we are always looking for counterintuitive ways of thinking about the world. And like, there's just nothing better than producing a paper that like Red Auerbach could get so mad about
right. That
he just like screams at a reporter about it, right?
So I want to get into some of the reasons why maybe the study was flawed. But first, I'm curious if through your research or off of, you know, maybe other things that you've written about or studied, are there other studies like this where intuition is fighting so much with the result that come to mind for you that would be something that we all would think the opposite of what the study concluded?
You know, nothing comes to mind, but I think that is like, that is the mark of a good paper, right? Like, I think we should always be challenging our long-held beliefs. And in fact, like, there's this incredible irony to this saga of this particular idea that like, we all thought this thing to be true, only to be told that it wasn't, only to then double back and realize that maybe it actually was.
Right.
So like, as soon as this counterintuitive paper sort of became conventional wisdom, people then started thinking, well, is this right? And we changed our minds again. And like, I don't think changing our minds is a bad thing. I think it's actually a good thing. I think we should be like seeking out better data and like listening to that data and figuring out what it tells us. Because like, we know so much more about the world than we did in 1985. We know
right. More
now than we did in 2014 when some of these papers were written. So, it's something to think about, like a paper in 1985 was based on the best data available then. That data just happens to look fairly primitive now.
I'm curious if you can explain the reasons why the paper potentially was flawed were twofold. If you can get into both of those.
Sure. There are two. There, one is that, we have better data now. And so there was a paper in 2014, by a team of Harvard undergraduates. So not grad students or PhD students or professors, but like kids in their college dorm. And they were able to get access to, the SportView cameras that were in every NBA arena then that were, you know, producing this data that the original researchers could not imagine in their wildest, wonkiest, nerdiest dreams, right? It could tell you everything you want to know about a shot. And so the flaw in terms of data in that original paper is that it kind of assumed that all shots were the same. So if someone made two layups in a row and then made a third layup, that's quite different than Steph Curry making three mm-hmm. threes in a row and then shooting a 30 footer, right? We just weren't able to control for that until very, very recently. And so once you are able to control for the difficulty of a shot, because what we know about the hot hand is that it warps the behavior of everybody on the court. And when someone is hot, they feel like they have permission to take longer shots and crazier shots and riskier shots, shots that are less likely to go in. So that had always masked the presence of a hot hand. It had disguised it.
Right, like a heat check.
A heat check,
exactly. A heat check like, actually throws off the data because then you're shooting because you're feeling it, not the shot that in theory should continue to go in if you're just following with your standard play.
That's exactly right. So what these Harvard undergrads were able to do was control for the difficulty of a heat check, essentially. And once they did that, there was some evidence that there might really be such a thing as the hot hand. Now, this goes to show like how much data has changed. So in 1985, there was only one NBA team that was keeping track of the chronology of shots. So like forget about like what the shots were, just like what order the shots were taken. Now we know so much about a given shot. Like we know the distance of the defender. We know the distance of the shot, like down to the very inch, and we're able to do much more with that. And so, so that was really, a powerful study. It was really the first time that there was good data suggesting that there might be such a thing as the hot hand. Now, the second attack on this first paper, is really interesting and very, very hard to explain. But really what, these two young American economists in Europe did was they found this very, very subtle mathematical bias that even the world's brightest mathematicians had missed for 35 years. And it suggests that when we were looking for the hot hand, we were looking for it in the wrong way, and that the test that was used, the statistical test in the first paper, was biased. And so sort of the easiest way to think about this, if there is an easy way to think about this, is that for many years, if a 50% shooter shot 50% when he was hot, that was always considered evidence against the hot hand, when in fact, it should have been taken as evidence for the hot hand. Because of this really like hard to explain, hard to wrap your mind around quirk, but the math of this paper has been peer reviewed and rubber stamped, and it's right. It's just, it's really hard to wrap your mind around, which is why we had missed it for all of these years. So these two things together have really called the greater meaning of that first paper into question. But there is still like that question in the first paper of like, do we see patterns where they don't exist? And what does that mean? That I think is really important. And, you know, we should not think of the hot hand as this fireball of NBA Jam in our imagination. It's much more subtle. And I like to think a lot more interesting than that.
So I'm curious, as you're studying the hot hand, do you think it's the same thing as flow state? Because we talk about flow state in psychology as being in the zone, and we talk about the hot hand as being in the zone. So that Venn diagram of crossing over, what we think about being in flow state, it's, you know, you're fully immersed, you're totally focused, you're like able to do something without being distracted by the outside world, which doesn't mean you're necessarily doing it better than you would on average. Although one would think, if you're giving it all of your focus, then you might be accomplishing more and doing better, being more productive in that sense of flow than you normally would. Is it the same thing?
I think it's similar. I don't think it's quite the same thing. Like, I think that when we are in that flow state, or when we do have the hot hand, we sort of feel unconscious, right? Like something magical is happening, and we are trying to bottle that magic for as long as possible. The difference, I think, is that there's a real like long-term momentum to getting hot, I think. It's not just a short-term thing. There's a real power and force to it. And I also think, I like to think of the hot hand as when, talent meets circumstance with like a little bit of luck thrown in. So you can get, like you can be in a flow state in practice or even in a game, but what makes the hot hand different, I think, is that resources become available to you when you're hot, and like to take advantage of them is really important. So like if you are in a flow state in basketball, that doesn't mean anything if you can't get the ball, right? So when you have the hot hand, like your teammates are trying to get you the ball, and the coach is trying to call plays for you, and you have license to take heat check. So I think the hot hand and flow states are sort of like distant cousins in a little way. They kind of like see each other at family reunions and maybe they chat there. But I think that there's a greater power to this idea of the hot hand than simply being in a flow state.
So I actually took a class in college with Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, which was not specifically about flow state, but he's the one who came up with the idea of it. And he described it as such because it was the idea of sort of feeling like a water current was carrying you along through this very focused approach to something. And the way you just described it made it sound like maybe flow state is individual and a hot hand requires other people to help facilitate it. Is that right?
I think that you need certain circumstances. I think that the flow state certainly is an individual pursuit. I think in order to capitalize on it, certain things have to break your way. And so you sort of transcend the flow state and you like come back into the world.
Okay.
If that makes any sense.
Okay. So it's almost like being able to take flow state into other spaces instead of it being this like pursuit on its own.
That's yeah, and to take advantage of it for there to be like real long-term consequences. And so like, I think that like Steph Curry getting really hot on a basketball court is like a good example of flow state. But I think that if you want to differentiate between the two, him like turning one magical game into like the turning point for his career and in some ways his life, I mean, that sort of shows the power of like a hot hand period. And when people look at streaks in other careers and other industries, and they look at like the hot hand period over the course of your career, I don't think that's necessarily flow state. I think it's sort of a different phenomenon.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about when we can use it for good, and then we'll get to when we can use it for bad. If we believe that the hot hand occurs, there's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy too. And like you mentioned, there are other people who need to look at him and say, he's hot, get him the ball. Is it as much about that belief? Cause in sports, belief is like half of it. Just feeling like I'm going to make this shot is half of what gets you there. So could someone who maybe doesn't believe in it as much argue that you're just explaining something that doesn't need to be considered the hot hand to be true?
Yes, I think that like you could, that's a very fair point. But when I think of it, I think actually this is where we go beyond basketball a little bit. So like if you are a movie maker, for example, if you're hot, there are resources available to you and you have access to opportunities that you would not have ordinarily. So,
and that's not just capitalism. That's not just people taking advantage of someone like you're making money. I'd like part of that.
Oh, I don't think so necessarily. Like, I think that like, you know, if, because it's not just, are you making money? It's like, is the quality of your work really high? Right. So, in the book, I write about Rob Reiner, the movie director, and like the first three movies of his career were This is Spinal Tap, Stand By Me, and The Sure Thing. And those three movies were all critically successful, but not all of them were commercially successful. Only really, Stand By Me was. But, I think it was very clear that he was sort of a genius director. And when it became time for him to make a fourth movie, he had this exchange with a studio executive where the studio executive said, like, essentially, you have the hot hand. Like, it's clear that you are on a roll. We want to make a movie with you. Like, tell us what movie you want to make. And he said, like, that's really nice, but you're not going to want to make the movie I want to make. And she said, no, I'm serious. Like, tell us what it is. And he says, no, I'm serious. Like, you're not going to want to make this movie. And finally, she puts an end to this Abbott and Costello routine they have going. And she says, just name the movie. What movie do you want to make? And he says, the movie I want to make is The Princess Bride. And she pauses and says, anything but The Princess Bride. And The Princess Bride had been this great white whale of Hollywood. Everybody had tried to make it. Norman Jewison, Francois Truffaut, Robert Redford tried to make it and star in it as as the prince. And the only reason why Rob Reiner was able to make this movie was that he was hot. This was essentially his version of Steph Curry's heat check, right? He could sort of pull up from 30 feet and do whatever he wanted to do. So it was not simply because his movies made money. In fact, he was successful not because he made movies that everybody wanted him to make, but because he made movies that nobody wanted him to make or thought would be successful. However, I think that like we are all luckier for it that he made The Princess Bride. Like, there are very few movies more beloved than that one, right? And so I think he was able to sort of elevate his career with the hot hand. And the cool thing about this is that like after The Princess Bride, he rips off this run of Misery, A Few Good Men, and When Harry Met Sally. It's like one of the great stretches ever. So I do think there's like a power, like a momentum beyond the momentum in a way.
I just want to confirm, Redford wanted to be Wesley, right? Not Prince Humperdinck.
He did not, I'm sorry, yes, he did not want to be Prince Humperdinck. He did not want to be, he did not want to be Princess
Buttercup. It's very odd for him to take a love for the film and then make himself the very worst character, but you never know. You never know. Okay. So let's talk about when it's not sports, because, you know, you can obviously make good on it in sports or something like creativity or movie making or something where people believe in your talent because you've exhibited that you're on a run. Well, actually, quickly, on the movie thing. So if you know someone is an incredibly talented director or screenwriter or actor, and they have a couple bumps in the road, is it fair then to believe that there's the reverse of a hot hand and that the next one will also be bad? Or is there always a belief in at least someone's inherent skill? Let's give them another shot. And then if they put another couple together, we'll think it's a hot hand again.
Listen, I think like certainly arrogance can sort of become ignorance at some point, right? Like I think that sometimes you take a half court shot and you miss, right? Like heat checks are not always good ideas. I think they allow you to do things that you wouldn't ordinarily get to do. And hopefully, those are ideas that like you don't get to do like because of reasons beyond anyone's control, not because they're not good ideas. But I think ultimately there's like a really optimistic, sort of uplifting message to all of this, which is like the only way to get hot and is really the only way to like break a cold streak, which is to keep going. And so there are scientists who have studied, creativity and like the science of streaks. And what they have found is that our creative hits are clustered and our best work tends to come in bunches. And so if you are to tell them like what your best work is, the chances are they would be able to pinpoint your second and third best work because it's right around that period of the best work, this period that they call the hot hand period. But what you think of as your hot hand period at 25 might be totally different than what you would think of when you're 50 or 75. The only way to know whether your hot hand period has passed or is on the horizon is to just like keep producing and
right.
keep going.
Shoot or shoot, which is like the reverse of that. Like I was just watching an old 96 Bulls playoff game against the Knicks and John Starks could not hit the broadside of a barn. And you know, the announcers at some point are like, you know, sometime you just stop shooting and you're like, but wait, shoot or shoot. I don't know. Right. At some point you have to take a hint.
I always think back to, there was a finals game between the Warriors and Cavs in either 17 or 18. It was in Cleveland. I forget which year it was. And Steph Curry missed his first 10 shots of the game. And then, he pulled up in transition and with like 2 minutes left in the fourth quarter and he made the biggest shot of the game. And it was like only Steph Curry would have the self-confidence to miss 10 threes in a finals game and
right.
then launch like the biggest shot of the game. But, you know, I think probably like you really need to like use yourself as a decoy at some point, but like you also have to shoot at some point too.
Yeah. Okay. So moving on to the things that maybe we wouldn't anticipate applying our basketball hot hand to, coin tosses, gambling, farmers, tell us some of the ways that we can use it for the wrong reasons or maybe be misled by it.
So I think just as important as knowing when to believe in the hot hand is knowing when not to believe in the hot hand. And more important, how to behave when you don't believe in the hot hand. And so I took a trip to the border of Minnesota and North Dakota, and I visited this friend of mine named Nick Hagan, who is a fifth generation sugar beet farmer. And Nick is like a sports nut and he believes in the hot hand in basketball. However, what
his real
he
name
has
is White
learned,
Fruit.
Yeah, I just went to the set of the office, basically. Yeah. So when I went out to talk to Nick about this and ask what he thinks about the hot hand, he had this brilliant way of thinking about it. He said that like when you play basketball, essentially, like you play offense. When you are in farming, you're essentially playing defense at all times because the single biggest determinant of a good year in farming is beyond your control. It's the weather. And you are essentially at the mercy of chance. And so you can't believe that like just because one crop did well one year or one patch of farmland happened to outperform previous years in one year, that it will happen again the next year. You're always just playing defense and controlling what you can control. And so if he were to say bet the farm, for lack of a better phrase, on soybeans because soybeans had two or three good years in a row and he's wrong, like Steph Curry misses one shot. It's not a big deal. It's one shot, but he could lose everything, right? And so he believes in the hot hand, but it's important for him to not behave as if he believes in the hot hand in his own industry. And farming, I think, happens to be like a very neat proxy for investing, right? How we manage our money, how we make decisions. I think there are certain environments where we can get hot and we think that a hot hand is possible. And those are the ones in which we have control and we have agency of our own lives. But equally important is when we can't get hot. And this is why those first original researchers were looking at the hot hand, because they thought that not only was it a cognitive bias, this illusion, but it could be costly, right? It could be dangerous. It could backfire and it can burn us a little bit.
Yeah. I wonder though, like if you're looking at something like farming where you're not, it's not I mean, of course you can be a good farmer. You can use the right amount of water and you can, you know, fertilize well and you can give it the right amount of sun based on, you know, your own personal factors, but you are dependent so much on the weather. Same with gambling, right? Of course, you know, there's more skill to blackjack than roulette, but you're still dependent on the cards. Those are very different things than sports. Even if sports, it matters if your teammate passes to you or how the other team is playing defense. If you are incredibly skillful and you're at your peak, you are in control. And so in the end, is it basically believe in the hot hand when it's a person or a skill set that's deciding what happens next and don't believe in it when it's chance or outside controlling factors?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think the crucial distinction is the one of control. And like, listen, even in basketball, there are factors that are beyond your control. The defense can change strategies. They can throw double teams at you, but like there are still benefits to the hot hand then. Like that means someone is open and you can take advantage that way. But I think it's really important to recognize when circumstance is not in our favor. And that's when we have to change our behavior and not believe in the hot hand. But it's funny, you mentioned gambling before. You know, to me, gambling is such a fascinating place to think about the hot hand, because like when we go to a basketball game and we see Steph Curry make three shots in a row, we all think he's making a fourth and that's the hot hand. But when we walk into a casino and we go to a roulette wheel and see red three times in a row, what research has actually shown is that most people bet on black the next time. They bet on the streak to end and not continue. And that's called the gambler's fallacy. And what makes the gambler's fallacy so interesting is that it's not simply about what happens in a casino. Like this is, there are real human stakes to this. And so, there's one really fascinating paper by these economists at Yale who looked at, loan officers and baseball umpires and asylum judges. And they found that even they are prone to making decisions under the gambler's fallacy. And so if an asylum judge grants asylum to two or three refugees in a row, he is much less likely to grant asylum in the third or fourth case, regardless of the merits of the case. So that's really crushing, right? That's not a trivial example of like when you call a ball or a strike, right? It's like whether someone gets to live or die or stay in the United States. And to me, that sort of speaks to what makes this idea so powerful. There are real human consequences to the hot hand and the gambler's fallacy beyond like whether or not Steph Curry makes a three-pointer.
It feels like that's subjective and, well, not subjective. It feels like it's subconscious. So why wouldn't they be able to say the things that I use to apply to whether or not I grant asylum never changes regardless of how many in a row I've done or not done?
Because they are trying to even out the streak in their own mind. They're trying to regress to the mean. No, I think very consciously. I think they think like this is the this is the percentage of applicants I should be granting asylum to. And because I have now granted asylum to two or three people in a row, I have to bring that percentage down. It's really hard for them to take this small sample. I mean, this is what like the law of small numbers is and why that 1985 paper is so important, because it was speaking to these cognitive biases and these ways that our minds play tricks on us. So even though they know that one case should not have an effect on the other, that's still how they behave. And in fact, even the economists who wrote this paper think this way. And so I talked to one of them, this guy named Toby Moskowitz, who when he is grading papers or giving exams to his teaching assistants, he now corrects for that bias in his own life. And so if you happen to read a paper or an exam that comes after two A pluses, it doesn't look so good, right? If even if a paper is like an A or an A minus, you might give it a B plus or a B simply because it's coming after the two A pluses. So what he does now is he takes every paper and he has it graded twice. He gives it to two teaching assistants and he shuffles the order. So that sort of reduces the chance that you're seeing a paper after that same A plus paper. It's not perfect, right? And we probably can't apply this to the asylum system that's so overloaded and like, you know, not really functioning as it is, but it's an interesting solution to this like curious little problem that he studied for himself.
Yeah, absolutely. That's so disappointing that there wouldn't be an awareness of that, you know, filing going on in your head when it affects people's lives or other decision making. I'm curious when you go and take this going forward after doing the first couple articles and now this book, is it affecting the way you view anything in your own life?
It is. It sort of makes me think that like when I do feel hot, which doesn't happen very often, but sometimes like I feel like on a story or even in just like a week of reporting stories for a newspaper, I feel like things are breaking my way. And you can understand why. Like if you are out in front of a story, people are going to call you back, right? Or if you are sort of in the zone writing, words fly out of you in a way that they usually don't. And in those rare times, I now sort of remind myself, like, these are really the times that I have to work hard. Because the one thing we know
isn't
about
that
the hot
flow?
Hand, sort of, yeah, but
so
like,
maybe it's
it can
both
kind
that
of,
time, yeah.
Yeah, it can kind of change things. Cause the one thing we know about this hot hand period is that it doesn't last forever and that it runs out. And like, that's a terrible feeling. Like you feel low and like you're crashing and you don't want to get there. So you want to try to make it last for as long as possible. In fact, when I asked Steph Curry about this, like I figured who better to ask, like, do you know when this is going to happen? And like, how do you take advantage? I figured I should probably ask the greatest shooter in the history of the planet. And what he says is that he doesn't know when or why or how or where it's going to happen. But once it does happen, you have to embrace it. And I think that's really the best way to think about it. Once it happens, you have to embrace it.
Yeah. This is fascinating stuff. And I love the applications to other things in life. Before I let you go, you do have to do the one thing that everybody does, but nobody expects.
Didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
It's the Spanish Inquisition. Number one, what's your desert island album? You can only have one.
Oh, wow. I really wish you had told me to prepare for this.
Goal is to have it be whatever first comes to mind, not what you want people to think you would say.
Red by Taylor Swift.
Ooh, nice. Two, what habit or quality do you think has contributed most to your success?
That's a good question. I think I've gotten very lucky. I think that things have broken my way two or three times that I could not have planned for and were totally beyond my control. But maybe I've tried to take advantage when that luck has gone my way.
Number three, what would you consider your biggest failure?
Not making the varsity basketball team in high school. Is that
wow, what a charmed life.
No, I don't know. That's such a lame answer. I think I've been like rejected for like every other job that I've ever applied for other than the Wall Street Journal internship. So,
well, it's funny because I often say that people who I have a lot of trouble with that question because most people who are successful don't get bogged down and think a lot about their failures.
Oh, that's not me. I think all the time about my failures. it's hard to pinpoint one.
Maybe that's it. There's just too many. Number four, have you ever been in a fist fight?
No, thank God.
Number
five.
For
me, not for the other guy.
If you could switch lives with anyone for one day, who would it be?
You know, the first person who comes to mind is Barack Obama, but that you probably get that answer like
I do.
All the
Barack
time, so,
and Michelle and Beyonce are.
Yeah, so I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. You know what? What about like Boban Marjanovic, just to understand what it's like to like be 7'5" and look down on the world?
I like that.
For one day only, right?
Yeah.
One day.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that,
and
that's,
preferably
that
on a day where you're, you know, flying commercial. number six, what's the most embarrassed you've ever been?
Oh, man. There was a day last year, I'm sure I've been embarrassed much more, but there was a day last year when a story I wrote got like dunked on Twitter, and that was just a terrible day. And it was just like, I just felt shame.
What was it about? I want to read it and then re-dunk on it and bring it back.
The story itself was fine, or I like to think was fine, but the story said that it was right before the NBA Finals, and it said that the Warriors were like in the middle of this dynastic run because of Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, Draymond Green, Kevin Durant, and Andre Iguodala. And in the story, the "and" in that sentence was italicized. So the "and" was doing a lot of work there, right? It was basically saying that each one of these people made very significant contributions. And if you take any one of them out, they are not in the position where they're in five straight finals. But when we tweeted the story, we did not italicize the "and."
Uh-oh.
And so it read like, you know, the Beatles are good because of Paul, John, Ringo. So people had a lot of fun with that. And I basically was called an idiot for 24 hours. But, you know, I've been called an idiot for longer.
Yeah.
Before, so
Twitter's good for that. It's a very humbling place, even when it doesn't need to be. Number seven, what's the thing about yourself you'd most like to improve?
I wish I were better at talking like to people. I'm really bad at schmoozing. And I feel like just in terms of like reporting and my career, I wish that like I were better at that. So there are probably many things. There are many things I wish I could improve, but in terms of my career, the one thing I always go to basketball games and I feel like I'm just standing by myself and feel awkward. So I wish I were better at just going up to people and striking up conversation.
One way to fix that when all this blows over, that I've heard a lot of people say that have issues with that, is to go take an improv class.
Oh, that's interesting. Do I have, So not stand up, but improv.
No, improv, because it's all about yes and figuring out how to react to what someone said, listening and then responding, coming up with something else. And that it allows you to just be more comfortable no matter what's thrown your way, to figure out how to respond because you have to. And then it causes you to just react differently than you normally would in conversation.
Maybe they do that by Zoom now.
They probably, I'm sure they do. In fact, I know the Second City is doing a show, I think either last night or tonight, with a lot of the couples who are together who live at home doing shows, improv shows via Zoom. So it's, I think everything is on Zoom at this point. Number 8, if you could be commissioner of life for a day, what one rule would you enforce that all of society would have to adhere to?
God, these are such good questions. The first one that comes to mind, which I guess is the point of this, is one that I think, we're going to get anyway pretty soon, which is that I really despise handshakes. And I think that handshakes, should be eliminated from society. So
I've never thought about them before, but they are pretty dumb and gross.
They're gross.
It has never occurred to me before that they're gross, except for when you get the clammy one and then you're like, ugh.
I was on a plane, not too long ago, although I guess it feels like 8 years ago now. It's probably like 2 months ago. And it was like, I think it was like a Saturday morning. I was coming back from, city where there was a small regional flight back to New York. And I happened to get bumped up to first class. And, at the end of the flight, the flight attendant came through and he shook hands with everybody in first class while we were on the plane. And I was in one of those Larry David situations where I was like, I really don't want to shake this guy's hand. We're on a plane. This is gross. And yet I had to. And I just, the pandemic is not good for many things, but if one of the results is no more handshaking, then I probably need to find a better rule for my one day as life commissioner.
There you go. Number 9, what's the most scared you've ever been?
Not to go back to, a plane, but I was on a plane with like terrible turbulence like 2 months ago. And I was like, it was at the end of like a work trip that I definitely didn't need to take. And I like was convinced that we were going down. And I was like, I can't believe that like I took this stupid trip. And it was one of those where it was like, we were going like through the clouds and it was just like 25 minutes of torture. And I was like shaking afterwards and I'm like, okay on planes. I don't get freaked out or anything, but this one was bad. And so, I don't know if it's because I'm thinking about planes because like it's going to be a while before I'm on one again.
Right.
But
a lot of plane answers. Yeah. No, listen.
Is that the one you hear the most?
No, it's completely different. It is often either planes or car accidents or something like that. And then people with kids, it's often something that happened to their kid.
Sure.
Their kid was sick or their kid fell or something like that. Number 10, what 3 words would you most hope that people would use to describe you?
Generous. I think generosity is really important. And I wish that, I hope that if people were to talk about me, it means that I would have gotten better at being more generous. Smart. I feel like I would like to be known as, smart and, I don't know, funny. I feel like funny. I feel like humor is like, it's really hard for someone to call you funny. And so if I ever, get to a point where someone were to describe me as generous, smart, and funny, it would mean I would have changed a lot in a good way. And so
nice.
That would be very nice.
I like that. Funny is an interesting one too, because I feel like it sucks if you're funny, but not good at things like math. Because when someone says, I'm really good at math, everyone's like, oh, good. And if you're like, cool. I'm funny, people are like, okay. Because it is subjective, of course. But like, I get told I'm funny quite often. And so I think I'd like to just be able to say I'm funny. But people are real dicks about it when you acknowledge of your own merit that you are funny. But no one's a dick when you say you're good at math.
Yeah. And also there's such a difference between describing yourself as funny and having someone describe you.
Totally. Totally. I'm only going off of peer reviews. You know, enough times people tell you you're so funny, then you're like, I guess I'm funny. I'm going to go with that. And then people are still like, no, you're not allowed to say that about yourself. You're like, I don't have any skills then.
Like,
what am I supposed to be good at? You get to be good at math.
I also like funny in the sense of, this is not how I was thinking about it, but I like funny in the sense of like, odd, right? Like,
right,
like
totally.
Funny little
You're
notion,
funny.
Right? Like those are what you're always wanting to go for,
yeah.
Right?
Well, this was awesome. It was really great talking to you and hopefully people will check out the book. I love that there's Princess Bride content. That's going to get me in every time.
Thank you for having me. I feel so inquisitive now. I need to, I think this is actually the most scared that I've been in a long time.
Oh, that reminds me. I forgot to ask the final bonus question, which is who should I have on this podcast? Who should I talk to that you find interesting?
Oh, you know, the person who I will always listen to on a podcast is Michael Lewis. So if you get Michael Lewis on a podcast.
I've been wanting to have him. So yeah, that's a great suggestion.
He gives a great podcast. And also the person, you know, another – the person who I think is the funniest person on the planet is John Mulaney, and I will listen to anything that he does. So
he just launched his two-man show as a podcast. So I should definitely look into that.
He did what? Oh, Hello is a podcast?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I think also my last thing I would like to say is that the very best thing on the internet is Oh, Hello with John Mulaney and Nick Kroll at the 92nd Street Y being interviewed by John Oliver. And it is the funniest 90 minutes that I've seen in like a century. And it is,
and I love all
it is
those
just
people.
Pure genius and like brilliant. And like, I think his stand up is the funniest stand up on the planet, but like this 90 minutes like shows his humor better than anything I've ever seen. So I would highly, it's like, I watch it over and over again because I can't get enough of it.
Look at you providing content at the end of this. This is great. Thank you so much, Ben. This was awesome.
Thank you.
That's what she said.
It's time once again for South Bitch Sessions, where I rant about something that bothers me and I fix it. This week, ticks. Those little blood-sucking assholes. All we have right now to cling to in this hellscape of at-home incarceration is nature. Walks. Short escapes into the great vast unknown. Fresh air, sunshine, perhaps a beautiful vista. A mountain peak. A tree that's just blossoming in spring. A lake. Duck babies. There are any number of wonderful things that await us outside the door of our personal hells and jails. But I happened to escape into nature this weekend with my dogs. Took them on a lovely walk through all sorts of grass and trees and flowers and plants. And we got the oxygen we needed and returned home to snuggle on a couch and watch a movie, only to discover that not one, not two, not three, but four ticks were on me. Actually, three were on me. One was on my husband's head. Three ticks were on me, one on my husband. God knows how many other ticks are currently burrowed beneath the fur of my dogs, waiting to be discovered at the most inopportune moment, i.e., midway through a scary scene in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood when I felt it crawling on my arm and realized I had a tick on me, i.e. in the middle of bed when you're sleeping and something crawls on your head. These are terrible moments to be tick infested. And at this point, I don't know how many weeks I will live in fear that one of my dogs is carrying them into bed. We bathed them. We brushed them. I've scoured every inch, and yet the ticks reappear. Those mother ticks. All right. One day if I snap, it's probably going to be about this. And in fact, I believe I already have because I am living in fear. Great. Feel good about what we accomplished today. Ticks. There. I fixed it. If you have a dilemma for me, put it in the comment section of the That's What She Said with Sarah Spain podcast review area. You can give me 4 stars. You can tell me how much you love it and then give me a problem and maybe I'll fix it on a future episode. Thanks as always for lasting about an hour with me.
That's What She Said.